Storykeepers run out of bandages. History's washed in ritual blood. Traditions bleed in high-tech flood. Workers, not serfs. Terminologies change. Progress is evolution. Terminal strange. Blue Indians being pulled into melting pots. Grueling class rules the haves and have-nots. Industrial reservation, tyranny stakes its claim. Blue Indians, emotional siege in civilized stain.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7.
Don't know what to get your loved ones this season? Check out kboo.fm/merch to snag some KBOO swag to support community and media in style. While you're shopping for gifts, you can also make a donation to support KBOO's $75,000 goal for our KBOO Fights Back campaign, now through December 31st.
From Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Sarah Blanco. I'm contributing producer, sitting in for Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, we talk with a former diplomat of Venezuela, Carlos Ron. Plus, David Bacon joins us in the station, writer, photographer, activist for immigrant labor and human rights. And we talk Cuba, sanctions, and Olympics with Brenda Lopez of Cuba Solidarity Network, and a news update about the Oakland People's Arms Embargo and what they're doing tomorrow. All this straight ahead. And now on Flashpoints, we are talking with Carlos Ron. Carlos is a coordinator for the Nuestra America office at Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. He is a former Venezuelan vice minister and diplomat. Welcome to Flashpoints, Carlos Ron.
Thank you very much for the invitation. Pleasure to be here.
And I wish we were here for better reasons. We're going to focus on latest aggression against Venezuela. What's on your mind?
Sure. Well, last night, our audience may know, President Trump made this statement where he basically is calling for a total air and sea blockade of Venezuela. Furthermore, he is explicitly saying in this message that he wants to regain control of the oil, the land, and the assets that, according to him, Venezuela stole from him or from the U.S. This is important for us because I think, we've been undergoing over, 20 weeks or now of, aggression in the Caribbean Sea. First disguised as a drug trafficking or anti-drug trafficking operation. You know, we've heard all this rhetoric throughout this whole year that Venezuela has criminal gangs, that the Venezuelan government has ties to drug trafficking. But now I think, you know, the excuses are put aside and then we can really see what is this has been all about since the beginning. And it's about the oil. Venezuela sits on the largest oil reserves in the world. And the United States currently has an important deficit in its oil reserves. So I think that they know, they understand that the Venezuelan, you know, what we have underground is very valuable. You know, there's something that they need to, that they could use to replenish the supplies of oil, and that Venezuelan production is right now not at as high as that it's ever been, mainly because of the sanctions that the U.S. has placed on Venezuela illegally during the last 10 years or so, and that they have, you know, damaged the, you know, or have hurt the capacity of Venezuela to update its oil-producing infrastructure. So at the end of the day, you know, it is not about, you know, fighting crime or drug trafficking. It is all about the oil. And, you know, over 95 people have already died in the last several months of this operation. These have been extrajudicial killings because nobody has been stopped at sea to find out what their ships were carrying. They were bombed by the U.S. military. They were killed. Some people that survived were even, you know, shot again to see if they would be killed at the orders of the Secretary of War and some of the military leaders of the U.S. This has been a way to intimidate Venezuela, or a way to create tensions, enough tensions in Venezuela, so that there's a change of government. I see the best scenario, we believe, for Trump, or that Trump is seeking right now, is a regime change operation where he could place at the top somebody that is friendly to the U.S. and they could once again tap into the Venezuelan oil reserves like it used to be. But the thing is, since 1999, since the Venezuelan Bolivarian Revolution started, when President Hugo Chavez was elected and has continued since under President Nicolas Maduro, well, ever since then, Venezuela's oil wealth has no longer just, you know, just gone to the United States, but has actually been used in the favor of the development of the Venezuelan people. We eradicated illiteracy in Venezuela. We have had access to education and to free education, to free healthcare like never before. I mean, Venezuela's poverty rates dropped. Venezuela's inequality rates dropped. There was a growing, victory against inequality. But that was, of course, something that U.S. companies and U.S. interests do not like, because it's no longer profit for them. So this is what we're seeing now. I mean, this is once again another war for oil that the U.S. is carrying out, and it thinks that the Venezuelan people are just going to give in and allow this to take place.
I mean, from any lens, is there any way to stop him? Whether it's because he's violating international law, what, because he's blockading tankers, and the next step is to enter the country? Bomb?
You know, all these killings that have been taking place because of alleged, you know, drug trafficking votes and so forth. I mean, they were never stopped. They were never searched. There was never any proof that these boats were in any way carrying drugs. And the killings happened anyway. Now, you would ask, if you have the capacity of stopping a huge oil tanker, and, you know, sending it like in a movie type situation, you send in troops to, you know, take over the ship and, you know, and them imprison their crew, why weren't you able to do that before when you shot at the different boats? Again, there's no regard for international law, and this is the problem, because what you are getting to, I think, it's one of the greatest challenges we have. We currently have a multilateral system that is not capable of stopping these gross violations of international law. I mean, we have seen that, you know, the UN has not been able to stop the genocide at Gaza. Well, you know, we see something similar in this case. I mean, we need the United Nations to step in and say, this is illegal. This is an illegal seizure of a Venezuelan ship. These are illegal murders that have taken place against Venezuelan and citizens of other parts of the Caribbean. You know, today, the president of Mexico, Claudia Sheinbaum, she made a statement where she also said, you know, where is the UN? I mean, why isn't the UN saying anything about this? Where is the presence of the UN? We need the international community, the real bodies that apply international law, to tell the United States that you have to stop. This is a violation of all types of international law. It's forbidden by international law to coerce a country into doing what you wanted to do, just militarily and, of course, economically. And this has an affectation on all of the Venezuelan population. I mean, if your target is just the president or the government, well, you're taking the whole population of the country with you in this attack. We have to stress the necessity for international action to take place against the United States to stop, to demand, and to make sure that it stops this aggression. If you observe, nobody's calling for a new election. If any, you know, if you have doubts about an election system, you might say, well, let's have a new election. No, they're not calling for a new election. They're saying give power to these people, because this certain group of people is the people that have already said publicly that if they come to power, or when they come to power, you know how they say it, you know, they'll make Venezuela the energy hub of the Americas, and they'll, you know, supply the U.S. you know, with all the energy it needs. I mean, you're basically talking about selling your country's resources to the highest bidder. And that's not what this country is about. I mean, I think that the majority of the population has rejected this type of politics. I mean, we have rejected for over 26 years now. We have rejected neoliberal policies. We have rejected privatization. We have rejected all these policies that have increased inequality in the rest of Latin America. And that is what's really creating the need for the U.S. to intervene in other ways. Because it was no longer possible for them to try this at the democratic level. Now they have to do it at the interventionist level. This is part of this wave of, you know, of ultra conservative type of violent, you know, movements that we have seen throughout the rest of Latin America. I mean, we call it the angry tide, you know, because some people said they used to call the revolutionary governments at the beginning of the century the pink tide, and well, this is an angry tide. This is the Malays, the Bukeles, the Cast that he just won in Chile. I mean, it's this right wing advance that we have seen. A lot of them taking some of the rhetoric and the style of the Trump supporters. All things said, you know, if this was an issue of politics in Venezuela, then you have to let Venezuelans solve it. I mean, it is the right of self-determination that Venezuelans have to solve their disputes, go to elections, go to whatever means, you know, Venezuelans decide to solve their problems. You are not going to solve problems by intervening from abroad as a foreign power. You're not going to solve Venezuela's problems by overthrowing a president, by invading the country and taking over its oil and then deciding, you know, what to do with the lives of Venezuela, like you've done with many other countries in the past, you know, Afghanistan, Iraq, and, you know, we could go on. You know, this is what's important. I mean, I've heard people, you know, that support Trump always say, you know, they were against endless wars. Well, what do you think this is going to turn out like? What do you think an aggression against Venezuela is going to be? It's not a quick thing. It's a huge country. It's 30 million people. It's huge terrain. And Venezuelans are not just going to, you know, allow people to come in and take their country. I hope this is a good opportunity to see how ridiculous these claims are, to see how excessive these claims are by President Trump, and that, you know, the forces both in his party and others would somehow, you know, push for dialogue, diplomacy, common sense, and stop this operation, because it's going to be dangerous for the U.S., the people of the U.S. You know, the troops of the U.S. are going to eventually have to deal with this, and of course, to the people of Venezuela.
And we're talking to Carlos Ron, co-coordinator for the Nuestra America office at Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, and a former Venezuelan vice minister and diplomat. Wow, really just getting into it, but that's the time that we have for today. I hope that you can continue to do your work safely, and if you ever need us, we'll be here.
Thank you very much, and we appreciate it. I think I know all of Venezuela really appreciates the support that people in the U.S. that defend peace are, you know, doing when they bring these issues out to the public. Thanks again.
Thank you so much for joining us on Flashpoints, and bye for just now. With us now on Flashpoints, David Bacon, writer, photographer, former factory worker and union organizer. He has been an activist for immigrant, labor, and human rights for many years. No stranger to KPFA as a guest, as staff, as a show host. It's an honor, truly. Welcome back to Flashpoints, David.
It's a pleasure to be here, Sarah. Thank you for inviting me.
You currently have an exhibition of your photographs at the Shields Library at UC Davis. The exhibition is titled In Camps, Under Trees, and Evicted, about people living at the margin in Northern California. It's a collection of black and white photographs taken over 35 years, and it's essentially a traveling exhibition of nearly 90 works. And it's in honor of the 60th anniversary of the Great Grape Labor Strike of 1965. I want to provide an example of a photograph for people listening, right? You have one called Migrant Workers Under Tarps Next to a Field of Wine Grapes in Grayton, California. And it's a black and white photograph of three men under this tarp on these makeshift beds. The caption is, in Grayton, migrant indigenous Chatino workers from Oaxaca were living under tarps next to a field of wine grapes. Their cultural practices and family ties helped them support each other while looking for farm work in one of the wealthiest wine-producing areas of the United States. David, talk to us about this exhibition and what something like this photograph means.
Well, the photograph is what I would call a reality check about the conditions in which many farm workers live. One of the positive things about what happened with the group of workers in that photograph is that they joined together with community activists in Sonoma County and Santa Rosa, and together they were able to set up the Grayton Day Labor Center, which made it possible for jornaleros or daily working farm workers to get jobs in a dignified way and also to get treated more fairly. And the Grayton Day Labor Center is just one example of the kinds of things that farm workers have done over the years to change their situation. And you mentioned, of course, the beginning of the United Farm Workers. And actually the photographs in this exhibition really come from my own experience in which I worked as an organizer for the United Farm Workers in the 1970s. And that was really the beginning of my education by the workers and by the union about farm workers and about all things like issues like migration and immigration politics and the human rights of rural people. So the exhibition is a way of trying to show what the real conditions are. You know, that photograph was part of a project that we did with California Rural Legal Assistance and with an organization called the Frente Indígena de Organizaciones Binacionales, which is an organization of indigenous people from Oaxaca primarily, which has chapters in Baja California and here in California. And so together we did a project that was called Living Under the Trees. And what this tried to do was show in images the irrefutable fact that many farm workers live out of doors, some temporarily because they arrive for the harvest in places where there's not enough housing, and some because this is just the permanent price of low wages and high rents and lack of housing for rural workers. And so that photograph was part of this project, joint documentation project that we did. And that's also why the title of the exhibition refers to Evicted, because even for farm workers, and not just farm workers, but people living, you know, close to the margin, close to the edge, in Northern California, we lose our housing all the time because the rents go up, people can't afford to pay it, you know, the wages are low. This is sort of the crisis of working people. And so the show tries to place, you know, what's happening with farm workers in this context of what is happening to people living close to the margin in general, but also to show that people are not simply the victims of these bad conditions, that people do many things to try and change those conditions, whether it's organizing the Graydon Day Labor Center, organizing the United Farm Workers Union. In that area of Sonoma County, there's also other organizations like Jobs with Justice, which helps to fight for the rights of workers who are especially having to work during the fire season in the smoke and the heat, and the Northern California Coalition for Immigration Reform, which is campaigning for the what's called the registry bill, though it essentially, if it were passed Congress, would provide legal status for all the undocumented people in this country. So there are many things that people do. So this show tries to show both what the conditions are that people live in, and what people are doing to change them. And there are also some text panels in which we hear the words or read the words of those workers themselves.
Great. And David, how long will this exhibition be at UC Davis?
This exhibition will be in the library until March of this coming year. So plenty of time to go see it. You have to make sure that you go when the library is open. And so check first with the Shields Library, especially if you're planning on visiting during the holidays, because when students aren't on the campus, they don't always keep the library open.
You know, David, I came into this interview feeling very grateful for the work that you've done across time, you know, for farm laborers. And it's a particularly dear topic for me. And as a lot of people, myself and a collective crew from Flashpoints and La Onda Bajita, spent a lot of time bringing the stories from the workers to the radio, much like you have and so many others, right? They've been fighting for just basics, right? Rest breaks, clean water, protection from heat. Don't spray me with pesticides. Must I drink poisoned water, right? What are the living conditions? Am I sleeping out in the elements? Imagine in this cold spell that we're having, sleeping outside. And not to mention just wanting a living wage. And now, to see the fields raided by vigilantes under any badge or any name or any mask, workers being chased down, communities already struggling to breathe from the stranglehold of racism and capitalism and fascism. It's too much to bear, David. It's a beast of racism, the colonizer mentality. And it's like, people might say, well, wow, but it wasn't really ever dormant. But now I feel it's snowballed. What are your thoughts? When's the revolution?
Well, I think that we are in some very difficult times right now, because the Trump administration is ramping up this extreme anti-immigrant program, which includes the raids for sure, and also the terror. I think it's important to talk about not just the people who get picked up, and of course, one of the people who was picked up in these raids was an organizer of farm workers up in Washington State, Lila Juarez, who was targeted by ICE and by the growers and picked up and thrown into the Tacoma Detention Center for 3 months and finally had to sign the voluntary departure and essentially self-deport himself to Oaxaca in order to be able to get out of that center, and now is trying to help participate in organizing workers in Mexico, farm workers in Mexico. So there, you know, the program involves the targeting of workers in their organization, but also one of the things that we don't hear much about in the mainstream media, although in KPFA we do cover it, and that is that the Trump administration essentially has made a deal with growers, and that is that they are trying to make it possible for growers to bring contract workers, the new braceros, as we might call them, on what are called H-2A visas from Mexico, and making it more and more attractive to growers to do this, so that at the same time as the administration is deporting people who live here, immigrants almost entirely, who live here and are working as farm workers, then growers are kind of like told by the government, you can bring in braceros from Mexico on temporary work visas. And the Trump administration just recently issued an order which allows growers in California to essentially cut the wages of those workers by $6 an hour, which is about 30% of their wages. So the legal protections that formerly existed for this kind of indentured labor, semi-slave labor program, which were not very good to begin with and not very effective, you know, the Trump administration is just sort of wiping that away and at the same time lowering the wages. And what happens when they lower the wages for H-2A workers? And this last year, growers brought in about 400,000 H-2A workers. So, you know, you have to sort of see what the game is that the Trump administration is playing here.
We are going to continue this conversation with David Bacon next week. Next Wednesday, we'll have part two. For now, David, in closing, I'd like to ask you, what is the significance and importance of public radio to you? Significance of listener-sponsored stations such as KPFA?
KPFA is a voice of truth in a media world in which we're surrounded by sometimes outright lies and certainly a media that defends the unequal order that exists. We need media that is on our side. And KPFA is on our side and has been from the days, you know, KPFA started in the period in which it fought against the McCarthyite, you know, anti-communist terror. And that's where the station's birth was, really, political birth. And it's still doing that kind of fighting today. So we need KPFA to provide a vehicle for voices like yours, Sarah, and voices like Flashpoints that are going to tell us the reality of the world that we live in and help us to change it. KPFA is a voice for social change.
And voices like yours and your photography that enlighten us, open our minds, sure, make us feel every range of emotion, sad, mad, urgency, pride, ganas. And next Wednesday, we'll continue this conversation, part two, with David Bacon, as we look for hope and courage in these really terrible times. And we never forget the people who put that food on the table and what they must be going through right now. Thank you, David.
Well, thank you for your work, Sarah, and for the work of Flashpoints and KPFA.
Now on Flashpoints, I'm Sarah Blanco. We talk with Brenda Lopez, a young Chicana activist. She helped found multiple chapters of the U.S. Hands-Off Cuba Committee and is now part of the Bay Area Cuba Solidarity Network. Currently, she's working on a campaign to help Cuban athletes get visas in order to participate in the Los Angeles 2028 Olympics. Welcome, Brenda.
Thank you for having me, Sarah.
Last week, the U.S. military seized a Venezuelan ship. U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi posted on X that the FBI, Homeland Security, and the Coast Guard, along with the support from the U.S. military, carried out a warrant to seize a tanker used to transport quote-unquote sanctioned oil from Venezuela and Iran. But it seems the vessel was headed for Cuba. And Cuban officials have denounced the seizure, calling it an act of piracy and maritime terrorism. And they see it as a serious violation of international law. Cuban Foreign Ministry issued a statement stating that this action is part of the U.S. escalation aimed at hampering Venezuela's legitimate right to freely use and trade its natural resources with other nations, including the supplies of hydrocarbons to Cuba. Brenda, you recently traveled to Cuba. Can you talk to us about what it has meant that the U.S. has blocked supplies to Cuba, such as this oil, but also such as really crucial medical supplies and medicines? If you could give us some examples.
The U.S. has long had hostility towards Cuba, now extending to 65 years of sanctions, including the state sponsors of terrorism list. And this has debilitated the economy to a dramatic and inhumane way, where now they're having trouble receiving very basic materials, medical materials and supplies necessary to keep people alive. Currently, I started working on a campaign with Global Health Partners to send surgical sutures. But beyond that, just like life-saving cancer medicines for children as well is being denied. And part of that, a big part of that, is that one of the sanctions states that no products that are made, more than 10% made or patented in the U.S., can be sold to Cuba. And so this has left it up to basically mostly international support, as you're saying, like from Venezuela with oil, but Mexico and China and Russia and other big countries that have to do solidarity, acts of solidarity, and send life-saving supplies to Cuba in times of needs. Currently, they're dealing with an epidemic of mosquito viruses, which has been very debilitating. It has affected at least a third of the population. You know, these things are very preventable if they had access to things like mosquito repellents. That 1/3% of the population could be much lower, but instead we have people getting sick with chikungunya and fever that gives people pains for months, up to 90 days. And all their joints. And this means that the Cubans, you know, have to deal with the effects of this with no help of any drugs or painkillers whatsoever, because even very basic things like ibuprofen, acetaminophen, and stuff like that is difficult for them to get because of these sanctions. And so the situation is pretty dire in Cuba when they have great health system, but the lack of medicines and actual materials to make those efforts possible is very difficult. And I can give a perfect example. During the pandemic, during COVID-19, Cuba actually made 5 of their very own vaccines. But because syringes are U.S. patented, it was literally up to U.S. solidarity and European solidarity groups to fundraise millions of dollars and send a bunch of syringes to Cuba so they could inoculate people.
You're also working with Cuban athletes that want to participate in the Los Angeles 2028 Olympics, but the Trump administration is denying them travel visas. Talk to us about how it's so important to work on this issue right now and what you're doing to try to ensure that the athletes can travel freely and participate in the Olympics.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. As you mentioned, right now the Trump administration has denied visas for the 100 Cuban athletes that are trying to participate in just the pre-Olympics. So this is just the qualifying games that are prerequisite for competing in the actual 2028 Olympics, which, as we know, will be in LA. This also includes the Paralympics. And I guess our job right now with our campaign, which is called Let Cuba Play, is to try to influence the International Olympic Committee, who govern the body of the Olympics to advocate via its charter the right for all eligible athletes to compete without political interference, and for them to just stay true to their core values of rejecting discrimination of any kind and protecting athletes' rights to compete free from political interference, you know? So we're just trying to get these athletes to have the chance to qualify for these competitions that they have been practicing for so long, you know? It's a great opportunity for them, and it's a great opportunity to boost morale for the athletes and connecting to the world beyond what is normally focused in the media, which is these bad relationships between the U.S. and Cuba, for a chance to really show what the athletes stand for. In fact, Cuba ranks second out of all of the American countries in terms of Summer Olympics when it comes to gold medals, trailing only the U.S., you know, which shows that even though they're this small island with a suffocated economy, they invest and see the importance in culture when it comes to sports. And so we're leading this campaign, as I mentioned, named Let Cuba Play, where we're just trying to raise awareness and influence the Olympic Committee to champion fairness and opportunity for all athletes equally. The baseball team was trying to go to the World Baseball Classics in March, and their visas were denied. The Cuban men's national basketball team was trying to participate in the FIBA America qualifiers in Puerto Rico in February, and their visas have been denied. So we're just asking people to endorse our campaign, volunteer, follow us on Instagram, send letters to your Olympic Committee representatives. People can find information in letcubaplay.com or letcubaplay on Instagram as well. Yeah, make some noise for these athletes and ensure them an opportunity, an equal opportunity to play in the Olympic sports and be part of, you know, something that brings the world together.
Thank you so much for the work you do. Thank you so much for joining us on Flashpoints. Brenda Lopez from the Cuba Solidarity Network Bay Area chapter.
Thank you, Sarah. Appreciate you, your invitation.
This is the Electronic Intifada Newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 797 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. The Israeli army continues to kill and injure Palestinians across the Gaza Strip in spite of the so-called ceasefire enacted on October 10th. Meanwhile, a brutal winter storm is destroying tent shelters and partially destroyed buildings, as the Israelis continue to prevent the entry of prefabricated mobile homes and supplies to repair basic infrastructure. One infant has already died from exposure. Israel killed a child, 16-year-old Zahar Nasser Shamia, on Wednesday, shooting him and then crushing his body underneath a tank in central Gaza, according to the Wafa news agency. A man and a woman were shot and killed by Israeli fire, and a child was shot in the head and injured in the Halawa displacement camp in Jabalia on Wednesday in northern Gaza. Israeli forces shot 10-year-old Bayan in the head, reportedly from a gun mounted on a crane, while she was sheltering with her family in the camp. Journalist Bashir Abu Asher captured a clip of Bayan in shock and with bandages around her head, being cradled by her grandfather inside an ambulance. The soldiers, the grandfather says, quote, shoot over our heads and we have no place to take shelter. At least 7 Palestinians were killed in separate attacks in northern Gaza on Sunday, December 7th, including a 70-year-old woman and her son, who were reportedly hunted by an Israeli quadcopter drone. The Israeli army claimed that those targeted had crossed the so-called yellow line. Al Jazeera's Hani Mahmoud reported that the woman and her son were chased by a quadcopter drone about half a mile from the yellow line and, quote, left there to bleed to death as the aircraft continued hovering overhead, preventing anyone from reaching them. Mahmoud described the incident as, quote, just one of many violations throughout the day and throughout the past 50 days since the truce came into effect. He added that in areas close to the yellow line, many Palestinians may unwittingly cross the boundary because it is not visible. There are no clear markings or signage to show that this is the ceasefire demarcation that is a restricted and dangerous area, he said. Also on December 7th, a 3-year-old child, Ahed Tarek Al-Bayouk, was shot and killed by Israeli forces while she was playing outside of her tent in the Al-Mawasi tent encampment south of Khan Yunis. Reporter Ibrahim Kanaan filmed Ahed's grief-stricken family members carrying her little body in a shroud to a nearby clinic. Israel attacked a home in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza on Monday, bombing it with 2 missiles, according to local reports. The United Nations Humanitarian Office reported on Monday that airstrikes, shelling, and gunfire continued across all governorates, including in Jabalia al-Balad and east of Jabalia in north Gaza, in Ashujaya and Atufah, east and northeast of Gaza City, off the coast of Khan Yunis and in the east and south of the governorate, as well as east and north of Rafah City. Several locations east of the yellow line were affected, the UN said. Reporter Mahmoud Abu Salama recorded footage of Israeli forces firing artillery shells from inside the heart of Jabalia refugee camp on Wednesday, where entire blocks are being leveled during ongoing military operations, according to the local media collective Translating Palestine. Residents report intensified shelling alongside the movement of troops and armored vehicles, signaling a new wave of destruction in an area within the yellow line that is already devastated by months of Israeli occupation, bombardment, and forced displacement, they say. The Gaza government media office stated on Tuesday that in the 60 days since the ceasefire took effect, Israel has committed at least 738 violations, including more than 200 direct shooting incidents, 37 incursions by military vehicles into residential areas, 358 bombings and attacks targeting civilians and their homes, and nearly 140 demolitions of homes, institutions, and civil buildings. On Thursday, Gaza's health ministry reported that more than 380 Palestinians have been killed and 1,000 people have been injured since the so-called ceasefire took effect. Israeli military officials claimed on Tuesday that they are working on using the so-called yellow line, which keeps moving westwards, to designate a permanent new boundary for Gaza. While visiting Israeli occupation soldiers in northern Gaza, in the ruins of Beit Hanun and Jabalia, Israeli Lieutenant General Eyal Zamir said that the yellow line that was demarcated by the Trump administration, quote, is a new border line, serving as a forward defensive line for our communities and a line of operational activity. Zamir added that Israel would hold on to its current military positions, quote, we have operational control over extensive parts of the Gaza Strip, and we will remain on those defensive lines, he said. Earlier this month, Euromed Human Rights Monitor admonished Trump's plan to entrench Israel's ongoing control and rampant encroachment of occupied Gaza. Quote, the consequences of the U.S. plan to support dividing the Gaza Strip into green and red zones separated by a yellow military line carry grave risks, including the effective displacement of Palestinians from their homes and the transformation of large parts of Gaza into closed military zones under the direct control of the Israeli army, Euromed stated. The yellow line, marked by concrete blocks, has not remained fixed but has been pushed beyond the published maps, advancing in some areas by more than 1 kilometer inside the Gaza Strip. It is used to unilaterally redraw lines of military control, gradually expanding areas under direct Israeli authority, placing additional territory under closed military rule, and severely restricting freedom of movement. This practice entrenches de facto annexation and fragments Gaza's territorial unity in clear violation of international law, the group stated. According to information obtained by Euromed, This plan is based on transferring the Palestinian population from the red zone to the green zone through various pressure tactics, which are war crimes. The plan includes the establishment of cities of prefabricated container homes or caravans in the green zone, each housing around 25,000 people within an area of no more than 1 square kilometer and enclosed by walls and checkpoints, Euromed notes. Quote, entry and exit would be permitted only through security screening, effectively converting these sites into overcrowded detention camps that impose severe restrictions on residents' freedom of movement and daily life. The design of these proposed cities mirrors the historical model of ghettos, in which colonial and racist regimes confined specific groups to sealed areas surrounded by walls and guard posts, with movement and resources controlled externally, as seen in Europe during World War II and in other colonial contexts. This system of forced spatial segregation does not constitute temporary shelter, but rather creates imposed population enclaves in which entire communities are subjected to management and control instead of being treated as individuals entitled to freedom of movement, residence, and life in their original communities, the group added. Euromed warned that engineering units responsible for the plan have already begun preparing designs for the first experimental city in Rafah, pending the securing of funding to begin implementation on the ground. Quote, life within these temporary cities would be subject to arbitrary security control and externally imposed governance arrangements, leaving residents with no genuine choice to accept or reject them and denying them any role in managing their public affairs. This entrenches a new political and administrative reality that places the future of the Gaza Strip, the identity of its residents, and their right to self-determination on their land under direct threat due to external interference. UN spokesperson Stéphane Dujarric, expressing an international legal official's version of thoughts and prayers, responded to Zamir's vision of a new boundary line inside Gaza, saying, quote, we firmly stand against any change of the borders of Gaza and Israel, and that Zamir's statement, quote, seems to me to go against the spirit and the letter of the Trump peace plan. A brutal winter storm has hit Gaza, plunging hundreds of thousands of families into further crisis 26 months into Israel's genocide. And the blockade of essential humanitarian aid, food, fuel, medicine, medical supplies, and infrastructure and construction materials remains firmly in place amid a lack of any meaningful international political pressure. One 8-month-old baby, Rahaf Abu Jazar, died of exposure to cold after water gathered in her family's tent in Khan Yunis amid the heavy rainfall, Al Jazeera reported. Ismail Al-Tawabta of the Gaza Government Media Office said that nearly 300,000 families are without shelter as the storm bears down. Roughly 250,000 tents and mobile homes were supposed to enter Gaza, Al-Tawabta said. But there are currently 6,000 trucks loaded with aid stuck at the crossings, he told Al Jazeera on Wednesday. Quote, we are issuing an urgent appeal to the world, U.S. President Trump and the United Nations Security Council to pressure the Israeli occupation, he added. Gaza's civil defense rescue workers say that its teams are receiving distress calls from Palestinians inside displacement camps, reporting flooding tents and families trapped inside by heavy rains. Quote, despite limited resources and a lack of necessary equipment, our teams are working tirelessly to reach those in need and provide assistance within the available means, the civil defense stated. On Thursday, civil defense reported that 3 buildings have already collapsed in Gaza City due to the flooding and strong winds. The Gaza Government Media Office stated on Tuesday that with the storm bringing flooding and strong winds, Palestinians in Gaza are experiencing, quote, a recurring tragic scenario where thousands of families will face the risk of drowning, collapses, and flooding. The coming hours will document heartbreaking scenes of families struggling to survive inside tents that cannot withstand the rain or wind, amidst a shameful international silence and the absence of any serious intervention to provide even the most basic protection and relief for the displaced. Quote, "We hold the Israeli occupation fully responsible for exposing displaced persons to the dangers of the climate, given its closure of crossings and its prevention of the entry of relief and shelter materials, including 300,000 tents and mobile homes, in addition to the absence of alternative shelters. This perpetuates the denial of hundreds of thousands of their right to safe housing under international humanitarian law," the media office added. Turning to the occupied West Bank, a 17-year-old child was killed by Israeli forces on December 6th in Al-Khalil, or Hebron, in the south. Defense for Children International Palestine, or DCIP, reported that Ahmed Khalil Rajabi, quote, "was driving his family's car to visit a friend at Alia Governmental Hospital in the city center, during which Israeli forces alleged that Ahmed attempted to run over a soldier. Israeli forces opened fire on the vehicle, killing Ahmed. The soldiers then confiscated his body." DCIP said that, according to their investigation, as he left the hospital to visit his friend, Ahmed approached a checkpoint and saw soldiers stationed across from it. The soldiers yelled at Ahmed to stop when he was beside them in the second lane. The vehicle moved past the soldiers for several meters before Ahmed halted and backed up no more than 5 meters, when the soldiers immediately began shooting at the car, causing the car to slide. One of the soldiers attempted to open the driver's door, and as the car skidded, the front driver's side hit him. He then joined the other 5 soldiers in shooting at the vehicle. The car kept slowly reversing, swerving slightly downhill. At that point, an older man, a sanitation worker in the Hebron municipality, was hit by the barrage of bullets fired toward the car. The vehicle eventually stopped in the middle of the road, where the soldiers continued to fire at the car, killing Ahmed. An ambulance arrived, but soldiers fired toward it, preventing it from reaching either Ahmed in the car or the injured sanitation worker. A large number of Israeli army and police units arrived later. At first, the Israeli military stated that a speeding vehicle had opened fire on soldiers. They later withdrew that claim and issued a new one, claiming instead that the soldiers had shot at a car that attempted to run them over, DCIP stated. Ayed Abu Aktesh, the accountability program director at DCIP, said, quote, "There is no rule of law for Palestinian children. Palestinian families are left to piece together how their child was killed, and in many cases are denied even the basic dignity of burying them, as Israel continues to withhold children's bodies in violation of international law." Israeli forces and settlers have killed 53 Palestinian children in the occupied West Bank in 2025, according to documentation collected by Defense for Children International Palestine. Israeli forces have withheld the bodies of at least 61 Palestinian children since June 2016, DCIP says. 6 of the children's bodies have since been released to their families, while 55 Palestinian children's bodies remain withheld by Israeli authorities. In the village of Kariut near Nablus in the northern West Bank, Israeli soldiers used heavy machinery to uproot olive trees this week during the harvest season. Journalist Issam Ramawi captured footage of the bulldozers destroying the olive groves belonging to village elders in Kariut on December 8th. The Tel Aviv newspaper Haaretz reported that the military destroyed hundreds of trees in an area that the army claims exceeds the boundaries set by a military order, citing security measures and signed by the army's West Bank commander. Village council members said that the soldiers are also destroying wells, not only the trees. The roots of the trees were severed, the village council members said, and the owners could not reach them and attempt to rescue them. The council said that the military threatened residents that they would also destroy their houses if anyone tried to approach the trees. Meanwhile, in occupied Jerusalem, Israeli police and municipal officers raided the headquarters of the United Nations Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, on December 8th, cutting communications, seizing items, and replacing the UN flag with Israel's flag. This is the latest escalation of attacks against the agency, which was established in the wake of Israel's seizure and theft of Palestine by Zionist militias and the expulsion of approximately 800,000 Palestinians in 1948. UNRWA has not used the building since the beginning of the year after Israeli authorities ordered the agency to vacate all of its premises and halt operations, Al Jazeera reported. The agency's chief, Philippe Lazzarini, said that this latest attack on the agency follows, quote, months of harassment that included arson attacks in 2024, hateful demonstrations and intimidation, supported by a large-scale disinformation campaign, as well as anti-UNRWA legislation passed by the Israeli parliament in breach of its international obligations. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight Paying a High Price in Gaza by Khaled Al-Kirshali, writing from Gaza. I wake up at 7 a.m. and immediately head outside to the street to check our water supplies, Khaled writes. In front of the warehouse where my family lives are our three buckets. Only half of one of them is filled with water, and I know I will need to replenish our supply. I wash my face and start to walk over to the school next door to see if a water shipment has come. Along the way, I see my neighbor Fayez Shabbat, and he tells me that the water shipment did not come. During the week, only one water shipment came. I return to the warehouse where my father, mother, brother, and I have been displaced since February in Deir Abalah in southern Gaza. My mother is awake, kneading dough. I ask her what she wants from the market, and she asks me in turn what I want to eat. We ate canned meat yesterday, I say, so it is better to eat something cheaper today. It has been a while since we last ate rice, so she asked me to try and find 1 kilo of rice. My grandmother is listening to us, so I ask her if she wants anything from the market for my grandfather. She asks me to bring tomatoes, if there are any, and to only bring 4 or 5, as 1 kilogram costs around $50. I put on my sewn slippers and head to the market. My grandfather Ahmad, who is 82, sits in his wheelchair in a shaded area of the street. I say good morning to him and continue walking. After 5 minutes of walking, I pass by a neighborhood that has been completely destroyed. I pass by the ruins of a building where a massacre was committed by the Israeli occupation against the Al-Hawajri family. On a wall near the massacre site is a message written in red. Jude is under the rubble, 31 October 2023. God is sufficient for me, and he is the best disposer of affairs. Jude has since been pulled out from the rubble, though, as another message on the wall tells us this much. 20 meters from the massacre, I enter the spice shop, and I ask the seller for the spices and the rice. The shop is crowded. The shopkeeper creates and mixes his own spice mixtures, and they are popular. When he gives me what I ordered, I ask him to give me his phone number to transfer the money to his Bank of Palestine account. I pay $4. I go to a grocery store on the other side of the street. Adel Oda, the owner of the shop, accepted online payments during the famine. I greet Adel and look for onion, garlic, tomatoes, and green pepper, but I do not find any. When I ask Adel about it, he says that no vegetables have entered the strip yet. I exit the store and walk for 20 minutes until I reach Al-Bahasi Market. I go there because, at one time, I could find everything I needed in that market, but this time I cannot find all that I need. The place is crowded with people, most of them paying with their bank accounts as well. I pay $11 for a kilo of rice and $1 for ice cream. I exit the market and walk rapidly for half an hour in search of the vegetables. By 8:30 a.m., I have reached Al-Birka Crossroads, where I know a vegetable seller who will accept a bank payment. The man tells me that tomatoes are non-existent in the market and that the prices of onions and garlic have skyrocketed again. He also does not have green pepper. I have around $37 cash in my wallet. I go to a grocery store on the other side of the street and buy less than 200 grams of green pepper for $5, garlic for $5, and one small onion for $10. Then I return to the warehouse and give my mother what I've bought. Those are excerpts from Paying a High Price in Gaza by Khaled Al-Kershali, writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Gaza and around the world. In the Shati, or beach refugee camp west of Gaza City, on December 7th, Palestinians celebrated the Palestine football team's qualification to the quarterfinals of the 2025 Arab Cup. Journalist Aboud Abu Salama took photographs of people watching the match in a crowded room huddled around a television. He writes, quote, "Gathered closely around a small screen, Gaza residents watched the Arab Cup football match between the Palestinian national team and its Syrian counterpart. Despite the harsh living conditions in the Al-Shati refugee camp, this shared moment of sports brings a brief sense of unity and escape amid ongoing hardship." That's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisin.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
This is Dr. Caldicott talking on 90.7 FM KBOO. You all realize how terribly important this radio station is now that the federal government is trying to cut funds for National Public Radio, and you